There's one word in the reading that Gil did that I think that I would like to use as a pivot for everything I have to say today, and it'd be very easily missed. And to appreciate it, it would be well to give it some kind of historical context. This is from part of the book of Isaiah that was written by somebody, the scholars called Deutero or Second Isaiah. The book of Isaiah is very long, and people, most scholars believe it was written by three different people. First Isaiah, then his disciple, then somebody else. Because they represent different historical periods. I mean, not separated by centuries. But clearly they're addressing different historical circumstances. And Second Isaiah, beginning from chapter 40 and going to chapter 55, was written at the time that the southern kingdom had been destroyed by the Babylonians, the famous Babylonian exile. And that phrase has entered the language. So, typically, they did what all the people in the ancient world did. They would take all the intelligentsia, the political leaders, deport them back to Babylon. And so there was no temple, there was no worship, there was nothing. And then the Babylonians, their turn, were conquered by the Persians. So this happened around 460, 470 before our era. And the leader of the Persians was a man named Cyrus. And when Cyrus had conquered the Babylonians, he saw these Jewish refugees who had been there for 60 years, by the way, so they all didn't pick up and hie themselves back to Jerusalem. But Cyrus said, if you guys want to go back, you can go back, and I'll even give you some money to rebuild your temple. Okay, so that's the historical context. But the word that is truly stunning is that Cyrus, this pagan, is called God's anointed, God's Messiah, because that's the Hebrew word for anointed, or God's Christ, if you wanted to talk about it in Greek. Think about it. So here's this pagan called God's Messiah, God's agent. And it says over and over in the text, although you did not know me, you're not a Jew, in other words, you're still doing what I want you to do. This is extraordinary. I mean, this is the heart of the Hebrew Bible where we find this. And so far as I can recall, it's the only place where a pagan is referred to as God's Messiah. I mean, there's that famous passage in the New Testament about this pagan woman, this Canaanite or Syrophoenician, depending on which gospel you're reading, who comes and asks to have her daughter cured, and Jesus said, I'm just here for my fellow Jews, and so we get this. The dogs eating the crumbs falling from the children's table. But this is even, in a sense, very more extraordinary. What has this to do, therefore? What is the religious significance of this? Well, it gives you an interesting twist on this famous passage, give to Caesar what Caesar's and give to God what God's. Historically, we know that there's a tendency of government to arrogate divine power, to see themselves as God's agent. I mean, listen to the rhetoric of W today. I mean, if he doesn't think he's God's agent, then I don't know what he thinks he is. So it would look like there's some kind of opposition, some kind of terminal opposition between what government say and what religion says.
And yet,
if you put that in the context of this Isaiah passage, then it's not at all clear. In fact, it's highly ambiguous. Could it be possible that the government is telling us to, or governments are telling us to do something that is according to the will of God? And although the text doesn't easily bear this significance, that, for instance, the churches do not. Let me give you a simple example from our time. It's always struck me as extraordinary that in 1948, the United Nations issued this Declaration of Human Rights, you know, the Charter of the UN, which recognized the freedom of religion and the dignity of every human being on the face of the earth. At that time, Catholic teaching was error has no rights, if you're old enough to recall that. Error has no rights. It was not until John the 23rd in the Second Vatican Council, where for the first time in its history, the Church says, as embodying the thought of John, error doesn't exist. Only people exist, and people have rights. And so we have embedded in the documents of the Second Vatican Council the same thing that 20 years ago the so-called secular world had come up with. And this is not just some kind of curiosity. Because finally, well, the upshot of this, I think, is fairly clear. And it's no more than a reappropriation, I think, at a deeper level, of Paul's pastoral injunction all the time, which is judge for yourselves. Judge for yourselves. Apply your own power of intelligence and understanding to look at the world and make judgments. Or that part of Catholic moral theology, which at least in the 8 years I was in seminary was barely adverted to, but which is part and parcel of the tradition, namely the primacy of conscience. The primacy of conscience. Where we're enjoined not to let somebody think for us or analyze for us, but in fidelity to the truth as we earnestly and industriously seek the truth to act on that. And finally, the theological base of this whole thing is again that great line from the Hebrew Bible, the arm of the Lord is not foreshortened. God shows up in the most implausible places. The whores and the mafiosi are going to get into heaven, to the kingdom, Jesus is made to say in the Gospel of Matthew, before all you pious types. Well, we need to attend to this. We need to attend to this. And not just some kind of vagrant, passing, transitory thing. It's a standard framework for our understanding ourselves and the world and the church.